Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Hello, welcome. My name is Andrew Gaines. I'm one of the PhD students here at the program in Educational Theater here at New York University. It is Saturday, April 23rd, 2016. Just to review the format for this podcast recording, it will last approximately 30 minutes. In about 10 minutes, we are going to allow, if there's any latecomers, there'll be one wave where some people join us. Unfortunately, this is not going to be our typical interactive sessions where there's Q&A or comments. Your role is simply to be wonderful audience members and spectators. You don't have to restrain any of your reactions. Microphones can pick up, you know, if you laugh or have any kind of reaction, that's fine. But there's not going to be a, you know, like a Q&A. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to our moderator, Edie Demas.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Yes, we are in podcast number 2 at the 2016 Ed Theater Forum. I'm absolutely delighted and humbled and proud as an NYU Ed Theater MA and PhD student and alumni to be here and to be with all of you. I'm delighted to be talking about arts-based research with three extraordinarily experienced and passionate practitioners of this work. Even in our brief emails and our quick cornered catch-up conversations yesterday, I know we're in for a really delightful and stimulating conversation, and I look forward to it. We're going to start with brief intros from each of our panelists so that for our podcast audiences, they'll hopefully be able to associate a name with a voice. And then we've asked Nisha to go last, and so that she can set us up with a working definition or a common understanding of arts-based research as a frame into our conversation here this afternoon. Okay, so Joe, would you like to kick us off?
Sure. Thanks, Edie. I'm Joe Salvatore, and I teach here in the Program in Educational Theater at New York University.
I'm Richard Salas, and as you can tell from the accent, I'm not a local. I'm from Australia, and I lecture in drama education at the University of Melbourne.
I'm Nisha Sachinani. I'm the Interim Director of Global Interdisciplinary Studies and Coordinator of the Drama Therapy Program at Lesley University, and I'm also on faculty at the Harvard Program in Refugee Trauma and here at NYU, where I teach a course on arts-based research in the Drama Therapy Program, which is also open to students in Ed Theater and other programs. And with that, I think I'll launch right into a definition for us of arts-based research here today. It's an emerging set of methodological practices that represents a very wide array of different artistic approaches, but where they're united is in their ambition to blur the lines between the arts and the sciences, or art and science, or art and research. It involves the use of the arts, poetry, dance, collage, film, for our purposes here today, theater, improvisation, playmaking, performance. It's the use of those arts as a primary process to investigate lived experience or as a means to participate in data collection, data analysis, data representation. So that'll be our working definition. Within improvisational and performative inquiry, we have a number of different approaches. Ethnodrama is very well known. There's also performative inquiry, living inquiry, and other forms of performance research, which we'll get into in our conversation.
That's great. Thank you very much, Nisha. And now to go in a little deeper, we're going to hear from each of our three panelists about their current practice so they can situate ourselves, or all of us, rather, within this working understanding, and then we'll go further and dig deeper. Okay. Richard, why don't we start with you this time?
Sure. Thanks, Edie. Well, for the past 10 years, I guess, I've worked as an ethnographer, and when I did my master's and my PhD, I conducted, for both of them, an ethnodramatic project, one of the reasons that I came to ethnodrama, or ethnographic performance as I tend to call it, was that as a contemporary ethnographer, what I was really interested in was sharing my data back with my participants and my findings. And particularly because in both instances, most of my participants were actually high school students, I didn't think that presenting them with a 210-page thesis was the most effective way of sharing my data with them. So I started to look for other possibilities, and I happened to very fortuitously stumble across the work of Johnny Saldana, and I guess that was a moment of epiphany for me, and I at that moment said to myself, well, it makes sense. I've got a drama background, I'm a playwright, theatre director. I think I can use this form to share my research findings with my research participants, and that's kind of what started me on the journey, and I've kind of been on it ever since.
So I was thinking about this morning, and I realized that I conducted my first interview 20 years ago this spring, in 1996, as a graduate student in a class called World Drama Contemporary Movements. And the instructor was teaching Anna Deavere Smith's work, and so she gave us the brief to conduct an interview with someone and transcribe sections and create a portrait. And so I always called this work interview theater that I was doing. And then when I arrived at NYU, Philip Taylor said, performed ethnography. And I was like, what is that? And then said ethnodrama. And I was like, what is that? And so I kind of resisted these terms for a while. And continued to make what I called interview theater. And then realized that the terminology had value within an academic setting. And so I started to sort of use terms like ethnodrama, ethnotheater, and then arts-based research, and found that language has power, right? And so being able to use these terms to talk about work that I did allowed me to have some stealth with my nomenclature. So depending on where I was and within what context, I could use this language. So I've been making this kind of work for a long time, and only sort of, I guess, within the last 5 years or so, I've sort of embraced this terminology. So
I'm really glad you said that, because I think that that is one of the... that is something that arts-based research, I'm holding up my air quotations, offers us as a way of framing and naming what we do. And, you know, I come from a drama therapy background, and it isn't a very big leap for a drama therapist to move into arts-based research, because we use dramatic improvisation and performance as a means of eliciting lived experience, organizing and working through that experience, representing that experience. And while research isn't therapy, we're using the same process. So like you, Joe and Richard, I've been engaged in using non-scripted forms mostly as a means of investigating lived experience. So that involved work using techniques like developmental transformations or playback theater or image theater, mm-hmm. devising process drama as a means of opening up life stories and as a means of shaping those stories. And so in... getting acquainted with the arts-based research literature that has been showing up or coming on the scene since about the 80s or so, but certainly much more popular now, I found a way to claim what it was I was doing in a different way, in a way that had value, that had currency within the academy, that allowed me to situate my artistic practice within my scholarship. So, as I said, most of what I do involves non-scripted work. It's more improvisational. I tend to refer to it as living inquiry. It's arts-based, embodied performance methodology that reflects life as we know it. We're just being intentional about the investigation. We'll start with a question, we'll body storm, we'll improvise. I've used playback theater specifically with people who are interviewers for others who have lived through experiences of genocide. So the Montreal Life Stories Project is a project I can point to with some specificity, where we use playback in particular to look at the experiences of people who had lived through genocide as well as those who were interviewing them for an oral history project. And that particular structure gave us a means of collecting life stories and simultaneously organizing and representing them. And then doing a bit of member checking, too, because in the playback framework, you turn back to the teller to ask them to have the final word. And in qualitative research, to me, that's akin to member checking. Mm-hmm. So that's one concrete example, in any case, of living inquiry.
That's great. So I'm thinking, as you talk and listening to you, about this being stealthy with naming what you do. It seems to me that there are both opportunities and challenges in navigating that stealthily, both in terms of the participants and then your potential audiences for the work. So could you talk a little bit about what some of those challenges and opportunities are that create this need to be stealthy and to think about naming in different situations? Mm-hmm. Anybody have a thought on that?
I think certainly in the area of stealth, I think one of the things that for me, whenever I'm seeing an output from some arts-based research, one of the things that goes through my head immediately is where is the art or the artistry and where is the research? And, you know, there are times when I see work that does come out of an arts-based research project and it may have very high aesthetics. But I sit there and I think, I can't pinpoint where the research was here. And then from the other perspective, I'll see a very worthy piece of theatre, something that is very well intentioned. But I think that perhaps there's a paucity in terms of the artistic side of it. And so I think if it is arts-based research, you know, we've really got to kind of bring together those, not necessarily in balance, but because, you know, it's not a perfect process, so you're not going to have a perfect balance of research and the artistic quality of the piece. But certainly, you know, I believe in an output from an arts-based research project, you know, they should be evident in the work.
Mm-hmm. I think, Richard, what you're saying is really important, because I think that I like to think of people who practice arts-based research as artist researchers. And I purposely privileged the artist, putting the artist first, because I feel like what you're picking up on is this idea that we often train researchers who then become interested in using an artistic form to convey findings with very little training in the art form. And so It for me, the training of an arts-based researcher needs to have both of those things on either side of the hyphen. You know, that there needs to be an artistic training and there needs to be research training. And I think that that's a tension, because I've experienced similarly very well-meaning, well-intentioned theater experiences created by social scientists with less of attention to aesthetics than I think is useful. And I think one could say, you know, oh, well, but it's a research project. But as soon as we attribute the word drama or theater to that research project, we have an obligation to pay attention to the audience's experience of that piece. And I think that that's where this notion of aesthetics that we, you know, have sort of been so passionate about in our pre-conversations becomes so important. And I think part of that is in the training of the artist researcher.
Mm-hmm. That makes me think about the artography work, the artist researcher, teacher, the kinds of roles that we play, mm-hmm. and how those work in concert with each other. And I want to come back to the aesthetics piece, but on the researcher side of things, I'm thinking about one of the challenges that comes up for me is addressing what Boal called cops in the head. Like, I've got to address my own cops in the head of what research is, mm-hmm. because I've been steeped in a post-positivist paradigm. I've been swimming in that soup that tells me that knowledge is finite and knowable and observable and measurable, and that there is a truth, capital T, and we're trying to scrape away at the, you know, at the excess to get at something pure. Mm-hmm. Whereas in arts-based research, In our artistic practices, we know that our orientation to truth is about embracing multiplicity and ambiguity and celebrating the fact that there can be multiple perspectives and emergent, that knowledge is emergent, which is a very different orientation, right? So in the same way, when I come back to the art side of things, I want to create work that is evocative, that is generative, that inspires curiosity and conversation, that doesn't have us landing on a single answer, just like good theater, right? Just like good theater.
Yeah, I think I always, so it, working in sort of ethnodrama and then more specifically in verbatim interview theater, I often talk about it being a meditation on a topic rather than an absolute positivist expression of our findings, you know? And I think about that as I'm scripting. I think about that, you know, as I'm sort of thinking about the ethno-theater part of it, you know, how are we going to convey this to an audience? In many ways, I feel like we forget about Brecht in this work sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, that Brecht's whole idea is that he wants the audience to be, you know, shaken awake and paying close attention to what's happening. And when someone presents an academic paper, they are trying to keep the audience sort of engaged in the data. And so we have to do the same as we think about the aesthetics, or do we establish clear rules of engagement at the top of a piece of theater, a piece of arts-based research that we're presenting, so that the audience can actually read it, so that the data is legible in performance, because it is performed. And so I think that, for me, I always come back to Brecht's notion of sort of Verfremdung, or alienation, or what film people now call distancination. And so how are we creating that sort of distance so that an audience can actually step back, not have a catharsis, and see the data, see the finding, in a way that is legible?
I think also, because it's a piece of theater, I think at times, you know, we feel perhaps over-obligated to show that there was rigorous research behind the piece of theater. Right. And, you know, as an ethnographer, you know, I've written in many different forms. I've written, you know, short stories, poems, and so on. And for some reason, I don't seem to get that kind of scrutiny. I think with any form of research reportage, of course, there's always going to be a level of subjectivity and bias that comes into it, and that is akin at times to an artistic process. And so I think that, you know, some of the less successful pieces of ethnodrama that I've seen is where the research kind of hits you in the face, where it's very unsubtle. But I think I think in a way it's the playwright or the ethnodramatist's attempt to kind of show that there was rigor behind the work. And I don't necessarily think that you have to be quite as unsubtle with your presenting your research findings as such on the stage, because I think that that if there's a good pedigree behind the play, it will come out anyway, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So research begins with a question. So sometimes I will orient my audiences to a piece of arts-based research, performed research, by letting them know what the question was, and providing a bit of framing. Here are some of my artistic influences. Here's how we've approached this piece of work, and the rest is open to interpretation. Let's have a conversation about it and leave it at that. I think what we're tapping into is another really big challenge that comes up in arts-based research, which has to do with translation. Mm. So you conduct a piece of arts-based research and somebody turns to you and says, well, what did you learn? What did you find out about X, about race relations in America, about autism, about mother and daughter relationships, whatever the phenomenon is? And, you know, we're trying to avoid landing on anything too concrete, because that in a way would be sort of antithetical. In the academy, when we're encouraging students to participate in this kind of work, another challenge comes up when, you know, they're up defending their research and there's the work, and does the work speak for itself, or do they need to be able to say, well, here's what I've come away with? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a tension there that I think comes back to translation. Mm-hmm. Although I've seen some fantastic student work where they'll take an interview, translate it into poetry to illuminate something about what they're investigating, and then take that poetry and translate it into dance, and then take that dance and translate it into performance. Those are all artistic acts of translation that are opening up different windows into what we're looking at.
That's fantastic to hear that spectrum. One of the questions we identified in preparation was, what is good ABR? What is good arts-based research? I think we've started to map that here. But then we also identified a sort of flip of that, which is, what is it good for? Mm. You started to speak about that just now, Nisha, as you talked about the inquiry, the inciting question, the phenomenon you're investigating. Is there any phenomenon that isn't appropriate for this kind of work, or what's particularly well suited to it, or what are you guys excited about? I think maybe some concrete investigations might be useful at this point.
It's particularly useful, I'd say, to explore issues around identity, where there's a complexity and an ambiguity and a changeability to experience. It's a less useful, well, I want to qualify that. I was going to say it's less useful, let's say, in maybe testing out whether this year's flu vaccine will be effective. However, the research around the flu vaccine could be disseminated in a way that is much more interesting if you were to use film and photography and narrative, et cetera, et cetera. So on the level of dissemination, maybe there's a role for the arts to play there.
Yeah, That's interesting.
And I think, too, that in the hands of a good dramatist, I think any topic is possible. And it actually reminds me of Beck's play that she wrote that Padgett talks about in her work, where she actually took medical transcripts and scientific papers and wrote an ethnodrama about it. And I think that there tends to be an assumption, I think, that particularly with ethnodramatic work, that the research behind it is always going to be qualitative in nature, and it doesn't necessarily need to be. Mm. You know, I think in the hands of a good dramatist, any resource material, you know, can turn into a wonderfully fashioned piece of work, I think.
I think work that is trying to answer a big question, which is not a very specific way to answer that question, Edie.
That's okay,
I feel like, you know, if I write a play, like a traditional play, it's usually because I have a question about the world that I'm trying to answer. Mm-hmm. And so as I think about that question, characters start to talk to each other, and I start to listen to them, and I write it down. And so, in similarly, if I think back through the different pieces that I've made that are ethnodramas, it's because I've had a big question. There was one about social class. There was one about open non-monogamous relationships. Mm-hmm. There was one about how adults think back over the effects of their childhood bullying experiences and how they talk about them as adults. Those are big questions, but the outcome is not to say this is what this is. It's to create a set of circumstances where audiences hear lots of people's stories and leave the experience meditating or thinking about how they engaged or were affected by those stories. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be it's got to be not positivist for me. It's got to be something that leaves space for the audience to actually have to work either during the performance or after they've left to kind of gain access to their learning.
Yeah, because I think the worst thing we want to do is close it down by what we show the audience, really.
Right.
It should be a springboard for further discussion, I believe, not just, you know, this is what I found out, this is what I'm going to show you, end of story. You know, it should be an ongoing conversation,
yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
Say, and for participants as well, those who are engaged in the play making, mm-hmm. The literal play or the scripting of a play, mm-hmm. That they too are involved in the investigation, mm-hmm. And are coming away having conversations about what this is. Mm-hmm. I love that you brought it back to big questions. Like, I think, you know, we have so many issues that surround us that feel enormous, and this is about making them accessible and personal. So earlier when I was saying I think they're particularly arts-based research is particularly useful around questions of identity, it's also particularly useful around relationship, mm-hmm. our relationship to the world around us, our relationship to ourselves, mm-hmm. our relationship to each other, mm-hmm. and how do we bring that into focus, because it's multi-layered and complex, and we're trying to work against dividing our experiences. This is mine, this is private, and this is public.
Yes.
We're trying to bring the public and private forward in relationship with each other.
So with that in mind, when you're in the middle of this multi-layered complex soup, how are you tracking what's happening and thinking about your outcomes? How do you know you're getting towards, I know it's not an answer, but a set of outcomes that then you want to share?
I think for me, the worst thing that I could do, I think, would be to sit in my little ethnodramatic tower and write my play and hand it over and say, that's what I found out. So certainly in the way that I work, there's a kind of workshopping that happens during the formation of the piece. So because I work in schools and because of my drama background, you know, I'll write something, present it back to the participants, actually get, I call them mini performances. And so what they do is they take the script and just as an example, what they'll do is that it'll spark for them. If it's literally based on something that actually happened, it'll transport them back to that moment, you know, and they'll say to me, yeah, Richard, you're kind of getting it right there, but, you know, like, he was actually standing over me when he said that, not next to me, and that's actually quite a different dynamic.
Sure.
And so that workshopping of the piece as well, for me, that is a kind of a member-checking, number-checking kind of exercise as well, but it also develops the work further, and it enriches the work. So so certainly when I say I'm an ethnodramatist, I don't mean that I literally just write a play and then it just gets put on. There's a whole developmental process that happens along the way as well.
I think this question really goes to analysis and when it is working, like when you're engaged in an artistic process and you have those moments of like, oh, it gels here, you know, and this is the moment. This is the thing that we want to track. This is the thing that we might want to retain, you know, as a scene for the play. And Richard, what you were just saying, you know, when you show it to other people, when you workshop it, to me, that's a bit, that's a lot like editing. That's like editing a paper. You take the performance, you bring it out to your mini audience, they read it, they sort of go, well, this is where it's working, this is where I'm getting lost, and then you start to hone it a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that anytime we're using sort of data that comes from real people, let's say, you know, I think that my skills as an editor in this work are much more useful than my skills as a playwright sometimes, if that makes sense. Like, I trained as a dramaturg, and so, like, my sense of dramatic structure, my sense of how to edit and sort of position things against one another, yes, it pulls on playwriting skills, obviously, but there's something about the how something is structured or how something unfolds that has been useful for me. But I think that I can't do it by myself. It's either like when I make these pieces here at NYU, it's always an ensemble of student actors working with me. They've conducted interviews. I might conduct some interviews. We go into a studio, and the data is all over the floor, you know, and we start sort of just moving it around. And then we do arrive at a certain point where there's a lot of voices. And I have to go away and start to do like a final pass. That's when my cat helps me, you know, and we sort of come up, you know, the script emerges, but then it goes through reading, you know, a reading process, just like you're talking about with participants. And so it's, I rarely have gone back to the interview participants in the work that I do, but it's an area that I'm becoming more and more interested in as I hear colleagues talk about their experiences doing that. I tend to get overwhelmed by too many voices in a process. And so, but I recognize that there's some agency in that in going back to participants to have that dialogue. And so it's a place like in my own practice that I want to sort of investigate.
I think also another great sort of check for me is audience. So one of the things that I'll talk about with those that are working with me on developing the piece is, who's actually going to see this? Who's this for? You know, like, it's not going to be for an off-Broadway show. It may indeed just simply be for other participants. It may be for a local community group or whatever it may be. But I think having that sense of who will actually engage with the work as audience, I think, is also a very important consideration when the editing and so on is taking place.
Mm-hmm. We're I'm very conscious of the clock, but before I try to wrap this up somehow, I wonder if we could just talk, and maybe this is the wrap-up, actually. As we spoke yesterday and continue to speak today, I'm very struck by how potent this exchange amongst you has been, and this idea of mentorship, of peer exchange, even validation almost as this work continues to emerge is. I feel lucky to have been a witness to it, and I wonder if you all have any thoughts to leave with us as we think about this work in the world and how we support each other in it.
I'll start. I think one of the realizations that I've always had with the work, but it's been, really been consolidated for me, particularly with the exchanges that I've had with Joe and Nisha this week, is that there's not one way of going about it. And that the form is evolving, relatively speaking. While it's now, you know, particularly ethnodrama, while it's got a history and a background, but it's still very much an evolving form. And it's one of the things that fascinates me with the form is to engage with other ethnodramatists, other people working in arts-based research, and just to simply share what I do and hear from them. And I think exchanges like this certainly help to further the form.
Mm-hmm. I completely echo that. I think this exchange over this last week has been so rich. You know, arts-based researchers, again in air quotes, are carving new terrain, right? We're saying, okay, well, I think that this is valuable knowledge. I think I've come to know something about myself or about what I'm interested in through my artistic practice. Do other people see what I see? Is that just something really wishy-washy that I ought to just keep to myself and not utter to other people?
Right.
You know? Yes. So peer mentorship, peer exchanges in this work is it's absolutely invaluable.
Yeah, I everything that both of you have said, and just to say, it's been it can feel really isolating, right? To work in an area that people constantly dismiss. I mean, let's be frank, you know, we get dismissed a lot. And one of the things that I think we have to do as a community is be rigorous about our practice and sort of have dialogue with each other like this, because like I can't do it in isolation because I can't figure it out without having the dialogue with other people. And so for me, it's about really listening to each other and sort of, you know, respecting each other's work and finding ways to have more of these conversations and sort of like not just the three of us, but like lots of people. Because if we don't do that, we get stuck, I feel like. I think one of the reasons that we're stuck culturally right now is that we don't listen to other people's stories enough. And I think that this yes. form is inherent in listening to other people's stories and learning from them. And so, you know, if I could say anything, like, let's keep talking, you know, about this.
Well, I have to say, on that note, and Andrew and Jonathan, I hope we're not putting you on the spot, but we had a little idea yesterday afternoon, which is our hope, our aspiration is that perhaps when these podcasts are put online, there could be comments fields and some sort of exchange. So that particularly around this ABR conversation, we would love to try to keep the dialogue going. And if there's one takeaway for me from this conversation, it's I'm thinking a lot more about feedback loops, dissemination, sharing stories, all the different ways we kind of say the same thing in this conversation. And I hope that maybe we can use this to stimulate some more dialogue and conversation on the topic. So, and I volunteer to help with that. So, thank you very much. This was terrific. Thank you for being here. This concludes podcast 2.
Join us tomorrow for podcast 3.